The red light and.
Okay. So now we have to figure out, and by the way, I apologize for the extreme compression of what's going to follow. Back a number of years ago when I taught a whole course in Baroque, in the Baroque period in music, I had worked out a lot of things and I hoped maybe I could squeeze some of that material in, but I think it's unlikely. So moving right along, we get in the year 1600. Now this is one of the reasons why the Baroque is said to begin in 1600, even though with the Gabrielis, they're sometimes said to belong to the Baroque, Andrea and Giovanni. But it's because a number of things happen. So the Camerata was a group of musicians, including the father of Galileo, who was a singer and lutenist, and Giovanni Bardi and others. They had gotten together and they had discussed what it must have been in ancient music that allowed them to move people the way they did, to affect their emotions. And so they decided that they would never know. They did know, however, that there was nothing like polyphony or harmony, as we call it, also, in ancient music. They knew this. They knew that ancient music was monodic. That is, it was a single line of music. If there were instruments, they all played the same notes. They knew that. But they also knew that after something like 2,000 years in the West, there was no getting away from the fact that the West had developed polyphony, that is, multiple voices singing at the same time and at different pitches and even at somewhat different rhythms. So the question was, what kind of music would be a suitable replacement that would still move people, that would move them to tears or make them joyful and so on and so forth? Above all, these were scholars, and they wanted a form of music that would respect the text. They said the problem with so much music is that it obfuscates the words. You can't understand what anybody is saying, A. But B, it wasn't enough just to have a comprehension of the text. The music had to serve the emotions and meanings in the text as well. So it's very important for the text to be, you might say, the most important part of music. Now, this is going to get entirely reversed by 1750. Actually, they don't keep it this very long, but they continue to pay lip service to the importance of the words. The words are more important than the music. The music is the servant of the words, or the poetry. Well, after a while, you get to Mozart in the 1780s, and he writes to his father, of course the music is more important than the words. In an opera, you know, the words are for me, the composer, to have something to hang his music on. And he says to his father, who goes to an opera for the words, after all? They go to it for the music. So you can see that after 1750 then, what had begun as the ideal for opera, Greek tragedy, now has turned into something very different. How did that happen? Well, let's look at the beginnings. So in February, Cavalieri performs the first dramatic text to be entirely sung throughout it. It's more like an oratorio. Now, I won't have time to say much about oratorio and cantata, the cousins of opera. An oratorio is a musical composition that involves an orchestra and singers, and which is based usually on a sacred text in a semi-dramatic fashion, but the singers, there's no action, it's not staged, they're not usually costumed. The most famous oratorios probably are Handel's Messiah and Bach's Passions. So the Lutherans
developed an oratorio that was based mainly on the Passion Week text. And these are dramatic music in a way, but they are not staged in any fashion. The cantata is usually a more secular composition. It's based on a somewhat non-dramatic text, although it can be somewhat dramatic. It's usually based on a theme that holds the various musical portions of it together in some way. And again, it's for voice or solo voice and orchestra. All right. So what makes the opera different? Well, the main thing that differentiates the opera from all of its precursors, that is pastoral plays, intermedii, and interludes, and ballet de cour, and the rest, which all involve singing, is that first of all, it uses a continuous text. It is a sung play, and it is sung throughout. However, the scholarly background of the opera is critical here, because the scholars developed, they realized that the choruses in Greek tragedy were all sung. It's not hard to figure that one out. We're told so by Aristotle and Plato and everybody else. What they didn't know was whether or not the dialogue was sung as well. And there were two different opinions. One was that the dialogue was spoken, and the other that it was sung. Now, in Bardi's circle, a number of those scholars, though not all, were convinced that it was sung throughout. But surely the dialogue wasn't sung in the same style as the choruses. Because as you know, the choruses are reflective. They represent, to some extent, a corporate or a collection of voices speaking together. And they tend to express the chorus's fears, its reactions, and so on and so forth. Whereas dialogue is a very different thing. So convinced that Greek tragedy was sung throughout, they decided that there had to be a different style of music for it. And they invented, therefore, a kind of singing that's halfway between speech and singing. And it was called recitativo, or recitative. And it was first used by Rinuccini and Peri, although there were precursors. In fact, there had been demonstrations of how dialogue might have worked in Greek tragedy, or if not how it might have worked, how it might work in the future by Vincenzo Galilei and others. And by the way, a number of the singers who were to create the first operas were part of this discussion group, the Camerata. All right, so recitative then links with something else, and that is the creation of the continuous bass, the basso continuo. So recitative is not accompanied by a full group of instruments, but only by the bass instruments, typically. And that too further removes it from the aria. Now the air, or aria, or lyric song, then is reserved for other kinds of statement. There's the chorus, and the chorus tends to be more and more homophonic, as we say. Instead of voices interwoven together, the voices tend to fall in the same rhythm. They're singing at different pitches in chords, but they are overlapping only a little, whereas in polyphony of the Renaissance and the late Middle Ages, the voices are overlapping all the time and quite tangled up sometimes. So here, it's usually described as moving from a horizontal series of lines moving like this to vertical columns of notes. And this too is characteristic of the choral singing. Now, we already saw that in Andrea Gabrieli's setting of the choral odes from Oedipus. And I've often wondered just how much impact that strange experiment had on later musicians. Apparently not much, because they had to choose styles that everybody was already used to, or it wouldn't work. Gabrieli's experiment was too radical. So Cavalieri performed his Rappresentazione dell'anima e del corpo in Rome in this year. And Cavalieri had been part of the Camerata, and so he uses a form of recitative. Peri and Rinuccini, who had been writing text for Intermedii, he and Peri, who was a singer and lutenist, created an opera called Daphne in 1597. We have only fragments of the music from it. You've read about this already, I think, I hope. But we can tell from those fragments that there was already something approaching recitative. It's not quite there. Now, in between recitative and aria, we have something called arioso, A-R-I-O-S-O, arioso. And that's intermediate between aria and recitative. And in the course of the 17th century, we'll find all three used. These days, when you go to the opera, you usually go for the arias. And 19th century operas don't have much recitative. That goes out at the beginning of the 19th century. Mozart still uses it, but it sounds definitely old-fashioned later. So then you move to arioso and aria, a kind of arioso between recitative and aria. But aria is more stanzaic and uses the same melody usually and repeats and so on and so forth. And arias are display pieces. Recitative is never a display piece. Recitative is meant to imitate the words in their rhythm and in their natural pitch. Right? So it's meant to sound like somebody in a sing-song, as it were. All right, so Daphne and Apollo. Why Daphne and Apollo? Remember, Apollo is the god of song and music. But what were the pastoral plays about? They were always about love. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. Well, that doesn't sound very tragic, does it? So instead of this comic ending, or at least comic story, you get boy or god, in this case, sees girl, God wants girl, God can't have girl because she turns into a tree. But Apollo is god of music and poetry seems like a somewhat appropriate way to create a new musical form of theater. In Eurydice, Eurydice, their next opera, 3 years later, which was for the marriage of Henry IV and Mary de' Medici, this is the first opera that we have all the music for, and so we can actually hear it. It was composed, it was sort of lost in the shuffle. A number of people heard it, and some of them were kind of bored by it. They said, sounds like Gregorian chant. But in retrospect, it turns out to be a very nice opera in its own right, and really, it doesn't sound experimental at all. Now, it's spare, it's not terribly spectacular. The music is fairly sober. Some people prefer the Eurydice to Monteverdi's Orfeo because it's so restrained. But it's 6 years later, or 7 years later, 1607, in Mantua now, this was in Florence, that we get the first great opera. So C'était vraiment writing about opera towards the end of the 17th century is speaking of the opera as it was to become, not as it was with Monteverdi and the others. To be sure, well, there wasn't much in the way of spectacular scenery in Euridice. There was quite a bit more in the Orfeo of Monteverdi. But by the way, look, these things were performed in rooms in a palace, maybe rooms about this size, you see. So we're not talking about a large audience, and we don't have much room for scenery. So it's only when the opera moves to the theater, and this begins to happen a little bit later, and particularly in 1636, that we begin to get spectacular effects. And it's in the course of the 1640s and 50s in Venice that we start to get operatic superstars. And then the opera becomes the vehicle for the singers and not any longer for the text. So Aristotle's Poetics, which was rediscovered at the end of the 15th century in Western Europe, they hear about catharsis and the affecting of emotions. The Council of Trent, words must not be submerged in music. Popular song supplies a model then for how you might construct a different kind of music from the polyphonic music that was characteristic of most of the 16th century and before. And finally, opera is a learned invention. It's not at first a popular art. It becomes a popular art by the mid-17th century, but it wasn't originally one. So there's Daphne, A Love Lost from God, who's the patron of music and poetry, and Eurydice, A Love Lost, and a famous singer who could charm his way to Hades. Claudio Monteverdi, composer of the first great opera, Orfeo, and many more. Unfortunately, we have only three of his operas, and there's some problems with the two later ones. Now, the remarkable thing about Monteverdi, we do have, by the way, one aria from his opera Arianna, which was written just after Orfeo. And this is the lament of Arianna, and it's said that the lament, which survives because it was printed, even though the rest of the opera doesn't, that the lament moved everyone in the audience to tears. And if anything demonstrated the power of music, this was it. But by the way, from 1600 on, what do you suppose is one of the most popular operatic subjects? All the way to the 19th century, when you get Orpheus in the Underworld by that rollicking composer who wrote all kinds of popular music, Jacques Offenbach. Anyway, it's a comic opera. And I should back up for a moment and mention that even though opera was meant to be inspired by and in some sense to replicate in the modern world Greek tragedy, very soon it began to move towards comedy. And this comes partly out of its relationship with pastoral drama. Okay, so we think this is a portrait of Monteverdi young. This is a portrait of him at about the time that he wrote Orfeo, and this is a portrait of him in old age. Fabulous composer, one of the greats, and certainly he dominates the first half of the 17th century. He composed madrigals, and it's interesting to work through his eight books of madrigals because the earlier ones are Renaissance madrigals, and then he starts to create a completely new sort of madrigal, and we'll listen to some of this in a minute. Now, because nights feel long to some of us and feel short to the lecturer who has a lot to squeeze in, I'm just going to give you the denouement of this evening. Because if I don't, I'm afraid by the time I play the music, we'll listen to the music appreciatively, and you won't understand what I'm talking about when I say the opera turns into the symphony. So let me give you a really quick overview here. 1636, as I mentioned before, a traveling group, a couple of singers, come to Venice. And you know, Venice is a good trip from Rome. At Rome already, remember, opera starts in Florence, but Cavalieri had done his sort of opera, or rather oratorio, in Rome. And there were some early operas in Rome. They were almost all on sacred subjects, lives of saints, like Saint Alessio, Saint Alexius, and so on and so forth. And so these two singers were from Rome, and they were entrepreneurs, and they got to Venice, and they said, let's do an opera. And so they already had an opera they had performed in Rome, and they hired local singers and musicians, and they rented out a theater. And the Venetians really seemed to take to this novelty. So the next year, they did an original opera. They got a composer, and the rest is history. By a scant, few years, by the 40s, there were three opera houses in Venice. And that's a lot if you think of the population of a city in those days. And they got up to seven at one point. So it was like the cinema. You know, it was a popular art in the way that the cinema was or used to be for us. And people came, and how did they make money? Well, this is where everything starts to change. So the first operas were learned affairs. They were for nobility and wealthy folk. But gradually, they worked their way across Italy. And when Venice, which is not aristocratic in the same way as the other Italian cities, remember, Venice is a republic, and therefore, it's a place where you can have an opera public, you know, a popular appeal. And so it's a Venice that transforms opera, and in a number of ways. So first of all, Venice transforms opera by making it into a spectacle. It's the art that combines all the other arts: painting, sculpture, theater, music, poetry. The authors of the libretti are always spoken of as poets. And by the way, the early librettos are considered works of literature in histories of Italian literature. And after a few years, now you have, one other thing in Venice. The operas were performed during Carnival, the famous Carnival of Venice. So they were a carnival entertainment. They weren't performed year-round. They were only performed during Carnival. And they discovered that there was quite an appetite for these things during Carnival. But the interesting side of this is that Carnival also affects opera. It begins to influence the style of the operas as well. So people came from all over Europe to the Venetian Carnival. And as a result, they encountered the Venetian version of opera. And they saw the spectacular sets, not that there hadn't been spectacular sets elsewhere, there certainly had. But it's at this point then that opera becomes something very different. The French were never very comfortable with opera. It was a very interesting opera that was produced in 1641, and that is only recently has the music for it been discovered. By recently, I mean the last decades. We've had the text, but it's an amazing text. If you looked at, say, Life is a Dream by Calderon, you would find many of the same things going on in La Finta Pazza, that is the make-believe madwoman, or the feigned madness, I suppose you could say. It's about Achilles, You say, what? It's about Achilles when he's hiding on Scyros among the girls because his mother, who's the goddess, doesn't want him to go to the Trojan War. And of course, there's a love story in this, but Deidamira, the girl he falls in love with and has a child by, wants to go to Troy with him, and he says no. He eventually has to go to Troy. And she pretends to be mad. And there are all kinds of funny things. Deidamira says to the audience at one point, is there a doctor in the house? And she said, a doctor who's had some experience with curing madness. If so, will you please come up here and help us with Deidamira? And at another point, one of the characters says, the machine behind this set is so heavy that if it fell, it could kill 30 Orpheuses. Now, bear in mind that this is not a play. This is all sung. And this opera, pretend madness, or the pretend madwoman, plays with its very spectacular effects and its very illusions. It's a very Baroque work. I'd love to see a performance of it. And there has been one, but not around here. Maybe somebody will do a DVD or something before too long. Alan Curtis has edited the text and did a production of it about 15 years ago. So this is the sort of thing we begin to get now in opera in Venice. La Finta Pazza toured all over Italy and as far as Paris. And it was Paris's introduction to Italian opera. But for various reasons, most of them political, and having to do with Cardinal Mazarin, who was Italian, it didn't catch on there, and the French invented their own form of opera, which was, on the one hand, informed by the ballet de cour. The French couldn't stand to be without their ballets, their dances. On the other hand, they wanted something that was closer to Greek tragedy, or at least a tragedy, and that was more in line with classic French theater, Corneille and Racine. And so, ironically, after Beaujoyeux, another Italian turns out to invent French opera. And we'll try to show you a little bit of a sample of French opera here. In a minute, we're gonna look at the Monteverdi, the opening of the Monteverdi Orfeo. And I want to play a couple of other things for you. I'll get to that very quickly. What happens in the course of all of this is that when Monteverdi's opera had 40 instruments, Peri's opera had only about 5. A basso continuo, you know, a harpsichord, a bass viol, and a couple of cornets and flutes. That was it. But when we get to 7 years later, when we get to Monteverdi's, he had a much bigger budget. He had a 40-piece orchestra, harps, cornets, all right, but you may remember, if you listen to the Possente Spirito, O Powerful Spirit, when Orfeo sings to Charon to take him across into the underworld, there are violins and cornets that alternate with Orpheus. Do you remember that? If not, listen to it again, because it's very much like the Gabrielli technique. Instruments then are in a dialogue with voices. In other words, instruments are coming into their own, and they're beginning to move towards a kind of equality with the voices. I did some research about, how long has it been? 15 years ago, on trumpet arias. So there are lots of operas in the 17th century and 18th century in which the soprano and a trumpet sort of challenge one another to sing higher and faster and more brilliantly and all of this. It's very interesting. The soprano sings, and then the trumpet sings the same melody, and they embellish them and do all sorts of things. Great fun, I suppose. Not for the trumpeter. Well, maybe not for the soprano either. So opera then begins to bring instruments up into the foreground in special ways. First of all, because there are instrumental interludes in the operas. We see this already with Monteverdi. And we begin to see it increasingly with the Venetian operas. And we get, and of course, the ballets, which are sometimes sung, but often or not are danced to music, we begin to get this division that we first saw in Gabrielli operating in the opera. Gradually, the aria becomes the showcase of opera. It stands out. The recitative is there to get you from aria to aria. And the aria you wait for so that the great singer comes out and wows you, telling how angry she is, or how unhappy she is, or how happy she is, or how perfidious men are, or whatever she sings of. And we all listen appreciatively as she sings the same thing basically over and over again in her aria. And then we go back to the recitative, and then we sometimes have choral song, which or other songs that are somewhere in between the arioso. And this goes all the way up through into the 18th century, so that there are very few of the major composers who don't write operas. Can you think of one in the Baroque period who never wrote an opera? Very great composer. Bach. Never wrote an opera. Went to them, went to operas. His teachers wrote operas, and he never wrote an opera. He wrote some funny cantatas, one on coffee. The father is concerned because his daughter, all she thinks about is coffee, drinking coffee, and she sings, coffee, coffee. It's a delightful piece, but he never wrote an opera, not even a comic opera. Well, all right. So how does all of this affect the symphony as it emerges? Very simply, let's look at, or listen to, rather, the prologue and the toccata at the beginning of Orfeo. I'm going to have to back up and out of this. We leave PowerPoint behind, and we search through here. And I hope I can find, let me put on my glasses. This close up, it's very hard to read anyway, but let's see what we can do here. There we are. Monteverdi wrote two amazing operas when he was 74 and 75. Okay, let's open this up a bit.
I think you just control F will make it full screen.
Yeah, but I don't have my keyboard.
Sorry. You can go up to the view at the top.
Now, these are all three of Monteverdi's operas were done by Jean-François Ponel and Nicolas Harnoncourt. It's all done on period instruments, period costumes, period theater, period sets. This was done back in the 70s, so it's been some time since this production. And so there's a sackbut. You know, they came in different sizes. Some of them were the same size as a trumpet. Look. And look on the fence. And there's Harnoncourt. They didn't have conductors back then, by the way. Thank you. notice you have this instrumental introduction. First the trumpets, tell everybody we're beginning, and then this lovely dance piece. And now a prologue. My beloved Parnassus, that should be. Very carefully here. Notice the basso continuo here is being played by harp and organ. Okay, you see, it's sort of a recitative, you see, even though it's in stanzaic form. All these references to how the heart is affected by music. This is music singing, you see? So this is programmatic. This is theory put into practice. That's enough to give you an idea.
Well, you have to go to the top.
I guess I do.
Or there ought to be, actually, there ought to be something down here.
Yeah. Whoops.
Well, that little thing will get the two arrows on the right.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. There we go. Thanks. Okay. So, what's interesting about this is, first of all, we see a prologue. In other words, the audience is addressed, and it's clear that the prologue is here to say something about this new art that's being presented. There was a prologue in Eurydice of Peri and Rinuccini also, by the way. And can you guess, if music sang this prologue, can you guess who the prologue was for Eurydice? La tragedia, tragedy. And she comes forth to say, I am here, I who make people tremble with fear, and so on and so forth. But she says, I am here in a milder mode, because actually Eurydice has a happy ending. Eurydice doesn't get sucked back into the underworld. Well, look, it was a royal wedding. After all, you're not going to make the happy couple feel very happy if you... say, oh boy, marriage is, you know, there you are. They don't work out too well sometimes. You don't want to say this at a wedding. But it's interesting that Monteverdi, so Peri, they're starting out overtly saying this is about tragedy in a new guise, modern tragedy. And it's interesting that Monteverdi then says, no, this is about music. That's what this is about. This is about music and the power of music to change people's ways of feeling and thinking. Now, there were all sorts of interesting things going on in this period, and I wish there were time, maybe you don't, but I do, I wish there were time to explore all of them in the detail that I would like. But since there isn't, let me go back a bit here to to oh heck, I'm gonna have to open it again, aren't I? All right, that can be done. I forget that I'm oh, wait a minute, sorry. I'm in the wrong place. I want this. There it is. Okay. Down here where it says upon. There we are. All right, just a bit of Cavalier. You remember now, he created the representation of soul and body just months before Eurydice. And let's see what his particular form of... Hello. It's a bit recalcitrant. Beginning to suspect that the DVD loads a lot faster than the memory does.
I don't know.
Oh, please don't do this. No, not the beach ball of death. and I can't do the whatchamacallit here. Let's see. Is there nothing to be done? Oh, it just doesn't like it, does it? All right, well, let's go back to this one. I had the foresight to duplicate everything in this one. Ah, there we are. Okay, so I'm going to play you just a little bit of the opening of La Tragedia and a little bit of the Cavalli, so you can compare. They're so close together in time. I think I'm going to do this. Open with. All right. Well, this is awfully exciting. Oh, recalcitrant machine, if you refuse to cooperate, I shall take you into violent measures. That is, I'll put one of the DVDs in.
You could try opening it in iTunes.
Yeah. Should recognize it.
What if you need to force quit?
Our keyboard doesn't work.
Well, it can be.
We can. It can be done. No, we can't pull anything down.
Yes.
Ah, here we go. Okay. Force quit. Okay.
Yep, it's all, it's got the, yep,
it's
oh
just,
yeah.
It's just not feeling
oh yeah.
very good today.
Oh yeah.
Okay, why don't you eject this disc?
First question. First question.
Never perturbed. Okay. Never surprised either by what computers
you
don't
be
do.
There anymore.
Oh, it doesn't even want to quit.
Oh,
it's really got problems.
All right.
Let's get you out of here.
I'll kill it. You ready?
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute.
I can try opening it in iTunes if you want.
Let's see if that works.
Where'd the darn thing go?
Oh.
Help?
Very strange. Okay, I'm killing it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure the mouse is working.
Well, push this.
Oh, it's
coming back.
Oh.
I rebooted.
Rebooted, okay.
Quit and down. All right, so let me continue here. While we're waiting for the computer to come back alive, if it does. Oh, now I touch on the back. Not going to boot because it's got a disk in it. Ah! One's worse nightmare. Never mind. We will do without them. I'll have to tell you stories. All right, so how do we get now from opera to orchestra? Well, you remember that I pointed out that circular area is what was originally called the orchestra in Greek. Now, orchestra means dance floor, and it's where the chorus in Greek tragedies danced. Ah, there it is. It has returned to life. Okay, see if you can eject the disc.
I'm sure we can do that. We'll get the view.
Something else.
Okay, and
there we are.
Ejecting. Oh, I see. Okay, I see.
That's very peculiar that it doesn't. Okay. So much nice stuff. We're going to watch a little bit of a French opera. Oh. This is Pitt's City. And while we're watching it, I'll continue to explain about the dancing floor or the orchestra. All right, so bear in mind this business of dancing. Because look at the background with the interludes and the intermedii and the mask and the rest of them. They all involve dance and, of course, orchestral music. And orchestral music, orchestra takes on the name of the dancing floor, ultimately, then becomes the main instrumental music. This is, by the way, an early music group in Montreal, Canada. What, should we just begin with Act One, you think?
Yes, you want subtitles?
Oh yeah, that's true, we do want that. And we want them in English, although...
That's fine.
Now, this was an opera from 1681, I believe. Very late in 1682.
Yeah.
Very late in his career, Lully had been himself close to Louis XIV, and he became the dictator of music in Louis XIV's France. And he started out in the Ballet du Cour and the Ballet Comique, and was a composer and dancer, and he retained all these elements in his operas, of course, because the French liked them. But what's significant is what happened with those prologues. The prologues get expanded as we move to the middle of the 17th century into what are called overtures by the French, openings. And the overture then develops into a form all its own. It's recitative, but it's not like Italian recitative. Of course, this is Perseus, you remember, so these are classical figures.
Thank you.
unfortunately, given the time here, I should put on my glasses to see this. Oh, that helps a lot. Okay, great DVD players. Okay, so very much in the style one supposes of a French play of this period. Much of it recitative. There's not the kind of alternation of recitative and aria that you get in Italian opera, generally, in this period. So the French are going their own way. Now, let's move forward a little bit here to a composer by the name of Antonio Vivaldi. And with Vivaldi, who wrote a lot of operas, by the way, even though he's mainly known to us for his instrumental music. With Vivaldi, we get a very clear sense of how this affective sort of, you always have to enjoy the prologue for these things. Okay, here we go. Okay, we'll be in English. Select title. Let's see, we want to, oh, jealousy, right? This is a good one. We don't have the words, but you get the point here. Problems with equipment, and this semester I've had 2 out of 3. Okay, let's try it again. All right, we want English, and we want. Why didn't we get
title? Subtitles. All right,
English. That's different. Okay, English. Start at the beginning. DVD menu. Okay. Okay.
Ah.
So the same text is repeated, you see. So it's the AABB structure that you get by this period. By the way, this was sung by a servant of Otho, who is a eunuch, and because he's a eunuch, he's a castrato, that is a male soprano. Here sung, of course, by a well-known woman. Yes, definitely. This is very much an aria. It's a display piece full of emotion. You know, arias don't advance the action at all. They express what the character's thinking or feeling. Now, she sings the first part over again, but with more ornamentation. I'm going to illustrate one last sort of, well, I don't know whether I'll illustrate it or not at this rate, but the transition now is to be described in a couple of ways. First of all, you notice that the voice sounds more like instruments, and the instruments sound more like the voice. The ideal throughout the Baroque period was still the voice. That is, an instrument was supposed to take the voice, the human voice, as its model. But as a matter of fact, instruments had a different style from voices, and instruments could do things that voices couldn't. This pushes the rivalry between instrument and voice into very interesting directions, and you see it here with what Vivaldi is doing. This could be a violin concerto, as a matter of fact. But no, it's an expression of jealousy and hatred and burning with the fire of hell and so on. On the other hand, there is the presence of dance music throughout the period. And what happens is that dances get worked into something called a suite or a sequence of dances. And so on occasions where you have instrumental music playing as a background, you have a series of popular dances, one after the other. This got worked into a musical form called the suite. And the suite took at its head the opera overture, basically from the French model of the opera overture. And what it did was to give you the opera overture first, and then a sequence of dances in fast, slow alternation. There are a lot of famous ones. They're sometimes called suites and sometimes called overtures. Some of the most famous are by Bach, but there are plenty of examples of overtures by all sorts of other composers. Now, overture here doesn't mean, of course, that it's an overture to an opera any longer. The way the overture works the overture part, that is the first part of the suite, is that you have a slow, stately music at the beginning, which is then repeated. Then it's followed by a rapid, dance-like piece. And then at the end, it goes back to the slow, stately music at the beginning. And then all the other movements in the suite are short, but they do this alternating either of rhythm, so you have 2-4, then 3-4, you know, 2 beats per measure, 3 beats per measure, or 6-8, which can be 2 beats or 3 beats per measure, or 4-4, different combinations, slow, fast. All the contrast we saw in the Gabrieli piece, then we begin to get in the orchestral suite. The orchestral suite becomes one of the first models as the orchestra itself gets created. So the violins and their cousins become the staple of the orchestra. This happens because of the opera. When opera goes public in Venice, they couldn't afford these enormous 40-piece orchestras that Monteverdi enjoyed because he was subsidized by the Duke. And so instead, they reduced it to just the quartet of violins and maybe a harpsichord and maybe a flute or two. Gradually, then, this crystallized, the orchestra crystallized, as it were, around this core, the core of the strings, which then begin to use the wind instruments as color. The trumpets, by the way, entered the orchestra, as you saw, at a very early point. And the oboe, by the end of the 17th century, then accompanies the trumpets and the flutes. And so gradually we begin to add more and more instruments to this ensemble. And then finally, we begin to write for an ensemble in such a way that the instruments themselves play different parts that are appropriate for the kind of instrument that we're hearing, both the sound and also the technique. So from Gabrieli on, the contribution of opera then takes this play between instrument and voice and turns it into a play between different types, different tones and categories of instrument. Finally, you end up with then music for instruments and some very major forms. The sonata, which is a solo piece for instrument and basso continuo. Then the concerto, which is kind of the aria of instrumental music. It's a display piece for the instrument in question, the solo instrument, or what's called the concerto grosso, the great concerto, where you have a group of instruments which play the opening section, and then you have the smaller group of soloists, usually three, who play alone. And you alternate between the larger group, the whole group, and the smaller group of three soloists. And this is called the concerto grosso, and I had loads of examples here that, alas, are locked up in some strange manner on my USB drive. Why does it all work at home on three different computers and won't work here? Ah, curses, jealousy. I am enraged with fire of hell. Anyhow, so ultimately what we get is the word sonata then applies to a musical form which consists of four movements. A fairly rapid opening movement, followed by a slow movement, followed by a minuet or a dance-like music, a movement, and then sometimes three movements, sometimes four, and then closes with a more rapid movement. And then you get the concerto, which is in three movements, fast, slow, fast. And the concerto grosso, which is in multiple movements. And then by about 1750, the orchestral suite sort of coalesces with some of these and turns into a new orchestral form. And this one takes the old name of symphony and now becomes very particular. So we have what is called sonata form. So the overture then turns into a highly specific form of musical organization. The sonata form consists, it really develops out of the sonata, but it's not the same as the Baroque sonata. So what's called sonata form will become an extremely important organizing principle for the classical period and the romantic period and thereafter. So what happens in it is that a melody or theme is stated, and then a counter theme is stated, and then you return to the first theme and you work variations on it, and then at the end of the movement you sum it all up. It's rather more complicated than that. You go through changes of key and modulation and all the rest. But for the first time now, we get a highly specific musical organization for a single movement that is more complex than the overture to the suite. The dance numbers in the suite get reduced to 3 then. So the overture turns into the first movement, the andante movement of the symphony. The second movement is a slow, usually somewhat meditative movement. If you think of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, in the second movement there is a funeral march, practically. The third movement, preserving its origins, is a minuet in the classical period, but Beethoven turns it into a scherzo, or musical joke. And then the last movement, then, is a sort of grand, not summation of the whole, because it doesn't usually go back to the musical themes or melodies from the other movements, but in a certain sense, you could say, in mood, it sums up the whole piece and brings it to an end. So without opera, this would never have happened. And even though we've now lost the vocal, what happens is that the dramatic scheme that originated in opera then turns into the drama that is incorporated in instrumental music. So even if you don't like opera, if you like other forms of classical music, you have to admit that classical music has been deeply informed by the whole, you might say, example of opera, and the whole notion of a new form of organization that is quite different from the forms that we had in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance in polyphony. I might add that polyphony comes back into Baroque music in the second half of the century, and there is a combination between the harmonic vertical structure and the polyphony, and that reaches its high point in composers like Johann Sebastian Bach and Georg Friedrich Handel. So they go back to the old rules, but they modify them in such a way that you can really have the best of both worlds. And in Vivaldi as well, although Vivaldi it tends to be much more homophonic in the way that he decorates. And then there's the whole question of embellishment and improvisation. The whole of the Baroque period, you never play a melody simply. You always embellish it with all kinds of extra trills and frills and doodads, musical doodads. And it's as though every melody has its commentary as you work through it instrumentally. And alas, the examples I had for that seem to be locked up somewhere in digital land and refuse to become analog again. Anyway, we've run over a little bit. Thanks for your patience, and have a good time next time getting to voice your own particular interests to the audience.